relativity weird enough for you? What do you think of this crap so far?
It's not weird enough yet. I'll trust to make it weird.
Yeah, actually, you're going to see some weird stuff today. And if you don't think of relativity as strange enough, as you're sort of doing these problems and everything, actually stop and think about the fact that this is how things really work. Right, these aren't just problem sets, right? We actually see this crap in the lab. So, you know, and your entire worldview of space and time has just been turned on top of its head. Okay. So, not to stop there. Let me review a little bit where we are. So last time we talked about sort of how to pull together the transformation of observations in two different reference frames moving at a constant block with respect to each other. And we stepped up the formalism a little bit, so we had derived the Lorentz transformations by basically looking at a couple of examples of an event in one reference frame and another. And so these are the sort of straightforward equations we came up with. And then we actually ramped up the formalism a little bit, and this is how we really write it, generally. And we talked about, we formed four vectors. So it turns out in these Lorentz transformations, you don't just have three things that get mixed up like you would if you had a vector and rotated it or something, where you might just mix up three coordinates. In this case, we actually also time gets mixed up. So clearly, when you do a transformation from one reference system to another, you have to deal with the foresomes. So we created what we called the space-time four vector that I'll summarize on the next page. And then we saw that if you have a space-time four vector in one reference frame, you can transform it into what it looks like in another reference frame through multiplying it by a matrix, which is the Lorentz transformation matrix. And so we're going to look at that matrix formulation on the next page, which is how we'll actually use it. I just wanted to show you what it actually looks like when it's written. So if you take much physics, you're going to actually see it written in this form, where this index is the index for the component of four vector, which we've done with the zeroth component, first, second, third. First was x, second was y, third was z, and the zeroth was time, so the space-time four vector was ct. So we're going to deal with four vectors, and this would be the component of the four vector. And what it tells you is that the four vector in, say, the prime frame, which I forgot to put the prime here, is equal to this matrix, the Lorentz transformation matrix, times the other four vector. And when you do matrix multiplication, which we talked about a good bit last time, this would be the form that we're going to actually use. And we've made a choice, which is we've made a choice that the relative direction of motion is along x, and we've made a choice that we sort of call the fourth component the zero component. And that those set of choices is called the metric. And you can choose different metrics. So you may get used to this form of the Lorentz transformation matrix and then see it in some other form. So the first thing to do is to think about whether you're dealing with a different metric. The basic ideas are all the same, but you might have a different set of, this might be arranged a different way. At any rate, to do the matrix multiplication, x0 prime is equal to gamma times x0 plus minus beta gamma times x1 plus 0 times x2 plus 0 times x3. And that's what gives you this equation. And last time we saw that if we rewrite what these things are in terms of the variables we're used to, so x0 is ct, for example, and x1 is x, that we can get the same equations that we've already seen for the Lorentz transformation. The second component here during the multiplication, minus theta gamma times x0, gamma times x1, 0 times x2, 0 times x3. So the idea is for each of these components, you do a sum over these different pieces multiplied together. And so, not that we're going to really be using the notation, but just to give you a sense of what this notation is about and how compact it is. This is called Einstein summation notation. And what you see here is that the trick is that when you have an index repeated, you actually sum over that index. So when you do the actual matrix multiplication, the index that you're summing over would be, for example, the index that corresponds to this one, that one, and that one. That's what gets summed. And so it's a very compact way of writing it, which if you say in this business, you'll see a lot of. I don't actually know if that notation is used much in optics or whatever. But it may, because there's a lot of relationship. Yeah.
So you say this is pretty good signal word.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, you don't have to put a big signal over you. It also has the added advantage that when you write it, it looks simple. It's clearly complex, and nobody has any idea what you've written. So it's job security. And it's very important in today's economy. Understand that. So it's very important for scientists to be as obscure as possible. Yes?
Is the last slide of the matrix is the one supposed to be?
The one supposed to be. Yes, thanks. It is. See, look at that. You guys are already correcting Lorentz transformation matrices. You'd be eating and sleeping matrices. No, not so much. This is the only one. Okay, so, at any rate, enough of Einstein summation notation. I'm not really going to do anything with that. I'm not checking what I was sort of showing it to you. Okay, so we form a space-time four-vector, having this as the fourth fourth component, zeroth component, the CT, X, Y, Z. The Lorentz transformation matrix and the Lorentz transforms are written in this way. Four vectors are cool. Just like when you have three vectors, if you take the dot product between two three vectors, you get a quantity, which is a number, a scalar. And that number then is invariant over things that are not invariant for vectors. So for example, if I have a vector and I look at it from two different coordinate systems rotated with respect to one another, all those components of that vector change. In other words, it's not invariant with respect to rotation. But if I take the dot product of a vector with another vector, I get a number, and that number doesn't care how I look at it, if I have a rotated coordinate system or not. So that is invariant over the rotation, for example. So in the same sense, we have something that's very important for four vectors, which is if we take the dot product between two four vectors, we form a quantity, which we say is Lorentz invariant. Which means regardless of what reference frame you look at it from, you will see that it's the same. So these then become things that are very useful for moving between different reference systems. So they're very important. And the way that one takes a dot product of four vectors is a little bit odd. You do the 1, 2, and 3 components, just like you're used to with the dot product for the 3 components of a 3 vector. But the 4th component, or the 0th component, comes in with a minus sign. And again, you may see it written like this. So now you have the indices that are summed over, and so that basically means you do the sum. So that would be Einstein summation notation. We'll often say maybe look at it that way. That'll have to be specific. Four vectors, you don't usually put a little arrow over them. So I'll probably have to tell you what we're doing. Because I'm not trying to be very religious about always keeping indices on for this class. Okay, so one Lorentz invariant quantity that is useful to have at hand would be if we have two events, A and B, which are described by four vectors A and B. And remember, each four vector gives you a three-space position and a time, so that's all you need. And we can look at the difference between two four vectors, which would basically be just like you have regular vectors. It would be the vector which has components, which are the differences in each of the components. And if we dot it into itself, then this basically is C times delta T. This is delta X, delta Y, delta T. And so if we take the dot product using this way of doing it, then we find that we get minus C squared times delta T squared, where delta T is the time between these two events happening in that frame of reference. And this is just the distance in that frame of reference. And it turns out this combination is now a Lorentz invariant, so we call it the invariant interval. So even though we found that in a Lorentz transformation, space and time get all mixed up and you can't really take it too seriously. For example, I can have two events happening where they're separated in space in some reference frame, and I can find another reference frame where they will look like they're right on top of each other. So it's sort of bizarre, but the invariant interval will not change. And so things where you are so far away that light would not reach you by the time the second event happens can't be possibly connected. So this is sort of what you use to begin to think about causality. So we defined a proper velocity four vector because regular velocity is complicated. Regular velocity has space on the numerator and time in the denominator, and they both transform, so the Lorentz transformation for regular velocity is rather complicated. You do have to use it from time to time, so we've done some problems on it. But what is better for relativity is the proper velocity, which is where we, instead of using regular time, we actually use the proper time for whatever it is we're describing. And proper time and regular time are related by gamma. So the proper velocity is gamma times the x component is gamma times dx, so y component is gamma times dy, z component is gamma times dz. And the zero component, if we define it this way, remember what we're basically doing is taking the derivative with respect to proper time of the space-time four vector. And remember the zero component for the space-time four vector is C gamma, CT. So if we take the derivative with respect to proper time, remember this is time, this is proper time, and they'll be related by gamma because of the time dilation. So that's where this gamma comes. So this is the proper velocity, and one of the things that we spent a bit of time on last class was to basically show that if you define a momentum using proper velocity, so we define a momentum using the proper velocity instead of the regular velocity, so mass times proper velocity, and we define the zero component to be m, gamma, c, where we've defined relativistic energy to be m gamma c squared. If you define relativistic energy this way, momentum this way, then we have an energy momentum four vector, and it turns out that with that definition, conservation of momentum works across the Lorentz transformation. So that's a very important thing. Okay? Any questions on all the stuff that we've sort of done? Okay. So I want to do a little bit with this momentum energy four vector now. Let us look at a Lorentz invariant. So let's take the momentum energy four vector and dot it into itself. Okay. And And because it's a four vector and we're multiplying it by itself, the dot product is going to be a Lorentz invariant, whatever we end up with. And so we have the four components here. So we want minus the zeroth component squared. So this will be minus e squared over c squared. And then plus m squared. And then we have eta, which is gamma times v. So, and we have the three components added up. So we end up with the three velocity squared times gamma squared, which gives us a 1 minus v squared over c squared down here. And I can't call this v squared because v is what I'm generally using for the velocity, the relative velocity of the two reference systems with respect to one another. So I can put that. So I'm going to use u as the three velocity. Sorry if that's confusing. That's another way that we preserve jobs in physics and engineering, is we use the same symbol for many different things, and you have to know from context what it is. So. Okay. All right, so look at what I'm doing here. So remember, the E is, we've defined as m gamma c squared. So E squared is m squared gamma to the fourth, c to the fourth. And we can rewrite the gamma to the fourth steps I want to skip here. So this term is the m gamma c squared squared over c squared, if I did the algebra right. Just annoys the crap out of me when it does that. Okay, so that's the first term. The second term is the same as we've written up above. That's a V. Okay, so if I regroup things a little bit, I'll combine terms and we get m squared, v squared, c squared minus m squared, c squared. You can work it through later and make yourself happy that I didn't blow it. Or make yourself happy that I did blow it. And so you end up with m squared, c squared times u squared minus c squared over c squared minus u squared. And this, all this algebra is equal to minus m squared c squared, which is really what I was after. So when you take the four vector, the energy momentum four vector, and you multiply it by itself, you end up with this quantity for the mass and the speed of light numbers. And this is known as the invariant mass because it is a Lorentz invariant quantity. So if we look at what we have up above, when we do the dot product, right, we have P dot P is equal to minus M squared C squared, and that's going to be equal to E squared over C squared, that's a minus, plus basically let's see how I'm gonna do this. Gamma M squared U squared over P squared. So how did I get that? That's gamma B, so that's P. Sorry. I looked through this and figured it out a little while ago, and now I'm looking at my notes and it's not making any sense. I really hate it when that happens. What did I do? Okay, so sorry. When we look up here, that's gamma squared, that's the m squared times the u squared. So that should be gamma squared. I don't know, I'll have to think my way through it. I don't want to do it right in front of you guys right now. I must have something really screwy in my notes. At any rate, what you get here when you pull these things together properly, which I'll clean up and put in the notes right, is you find that E squared is equal to M squared times C to the fourth plus P squared times C squared. And that is what I was actually after. Okay, so this is a relationship between momentum, mass, and energy in relativity. And it's a little different from what we've seen before. So we've defined relativistic mass and relativistic energy as this gamma mc squared. And so remember what gamma is. So this is mc squared over square root of 1 minus b squared over c squared. So one of the things that you will sometimes see is this rewritten as E over C squared is equal to M, it's 1 minus V squared over C squared. So I'll just pull a C square on each side. And this gets motivated by people basically saying this gamma M. And they say that as you start to go faster and faster, the gamma gets big. And so what they argue is that the mass is getting big, which is why you can't reach the speed of light, for example. The mass becomes infinite when you get close to the speed of light. If you see a book that writes like that, throw it away and find another book, because mass is a Lorentzian variable. It's very important that it actually doesn't change when you go from one reference frame to another. What changes is the energy. Okay? So I define this as the energy. The gamma factor does change, but it's the energy that's really getting big. Think of the mass as the fixed quantity, okay? And it's the relativistic energy that's changing. Okay, so let's look at the mass a little bit more. Because the way we've defined it, we have that the energy is equal to mc squared over 1 minus v squared over c squared. And the square root of that. Okay? And now, I want to look at this quantity and remember that certainly a limit that is of interest to us would be one where v is small with respect to c. So this would be a small number. So, in order to get a sense of what energy looks like at small velocities, what I'd like to do is to do a Taylor series expansion of that gamma. Okay, so if you recall Taylor series expansion, it's one of those things that you learn and you're sort of wondering, why are we doing this? There's a reason why you do this. It turns out Taylor series expansions are very useful in physics. You can see them again and again and again if you're not already used to it. And they're particularly useful when you have some sort of expression where there's one piece that's sort of small. And the reason that it's useful is because in the Taylor series expansion, what you do is you expand it in powers of this thing that is small. And so as you go up in the series, you have increasing powers of that small thing, and you can just neglect all the higher powers. You basically get a totally different expression. And you can learn something from that sometimes. Alright, so I want to do a Taylor series expansion. And so you go and you look it up, or you can typically, I mean, you can do it from scratch, but typically you can look up a table, Taylor series expansions for the form of the equation you've got. And if you go and you look that up, this is 1 minus 1 half to the x plus 1 times 3 over 2 times 4x squared minus 1 times 3 times 5, 2 times 4 times 6x cubed plus... Okay, so you can see the increasing powers in this quantity x. And in our case, that quantity x, in the limit that v over c is small, you can neglect the higher powers, which is why it's so useful for us. So if we do this expansion now using our form, where what I want to do is expand 1 minus v squared over c squared, so this is what stands in for x up above. And when I do that, then this will be 1 plus 1 half v squared over c squared plus 3 eighths v squared over c squared. Probably a plus, because you've got this minus sign here. No, that. Yeah, probably. Doesn't really matter for us right now. I know what the right answer is, which is what I'm going to get to. So if I blew the sign, I blew the sign. You can fix it in a minute. I don't know. I mean, I wrote this in 1991, so I didn't check every sign as I was getting ready for class a little while ago. I probably should have. Sorry about that. Oh, well. So what was I doing? Okay, so I said plus in my notes here. Could be wrong. Doesn't really matter. In the end, I take this expansion, I multiply it by mc squared because that's what we have on the numerator up above. So we have that the energy is equal to mc squared plus 1 half m squared. Because the c squares cancel in this case. And I have a plus 3/8. It doesn't really matter because we never get to the third term. Okay. So, if V over C is small, the third term is very small, and all higher powers are small. So typically, we don't worry about this. If you go to high velocities, you might begin to worry about that term, and you might worry a whole lot about putting that in the right sign. But in the meantime, I really want to just look at these terms. And so what we see is the relativistic energy is equal to this mc squared, and note that the velocity can be zero, and you still have this term. So this is what we equate as the rest energy term. And this is something new, because in Newtonian physics, you don't really think of mass as a form of energy. But in relativity, this term is always there if you have something that has mass. So mass is a form of energy. This term you probably recognize as the kinetic energy term, but the classical kinetic energy term. And then you have higher order things that you may have to worry about velocity. Okay? So, this is new and sort of cool. Turns out that, I mean, it heralds the nuclear age, right? If you recognize that mass and energy are the same thing, you have all sorts of weird effects. And one of them is that you have a way of changing mass. Reducing it, you can release the energy, which is what you get when you make transformations of nuclear states, you know, from things that have higher mass to lower mass. So it turns out that if you have a very large nucleus and you break it into two smaller nuclei, that the two smaller nuclei, the nucleons inside them are bound more tightly than they are in the large nucleus. And that difference is a release in energy, it also means that the masses of these two things do not add up to the mass of the big one. This is still a certain energy mass. If you take a pot of water and you heat it up, you can't measure it, but the mass also changes because you've added energy to the system. It's really very strange. If I have energy and I have enough of it that it can turn into massive objects, it will. So if I have light, for example, of high enough energy, how very high energy photons interact with matter is they actually pair produce and pair with electrons and positrons, things like that. So if I were able to take a pot and make it hot enough, eventually I would just start popping particles and antiparticles out of it, out of vacuum, which is pretty bizarre. This is sort of the foundation of some really weird stuff when you start to add quantum mechanics to it. So we'll come back to that a lot later.
Are there no experiments that are accurate enough to see
My guess is we probably have. Yeah, I don't know. We certainly have a lot with nuclear stuff. I don't know. It may have been done. All right, so let's look at this a little bit. Turns out that if we have a proton, the mass of a proton, is 1.67 times 10 to the minus 27 kilograms. So if you're into atomic mass units in chemistry, this is 1 AMU. And let's say that it moves at 0.7 C, then the energy is equal to 1.4 times mc squared, where the 1.4 comes from the 0.7c when you calculate gamma. So this is 1.4 times 1.67 times 10 to the minus 27 kilograms times 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second, which is the speed of light. And you end up with something like 2.1 times 10 to the minus 10 kilogram meters squared per second squared. Because this quantity is squared. Okay. Which is joules. And if you haven't noticed, that's sort of inconvenient. Right. Joules are not made for particles. Joules are a big unit that's really good for macroscopic things. But it doesn't work so well for things like particles, which we'll be talking about a lot. So it's not a unit that we actually see very often. So the kind of unit that we use, which is much easier to deal with, especially in the laboratory where you're actually trying to do experiments with particles, is what we call the electron volt, which I hope you've seen in physics 122 or whatever. So, 1 EV is an electron volt, and this is the energy gained by a unit charge, say one electron, moving through a potential difference of 1 volt, which you can imagine doing, right? You can have a hot wire where the electrons aren't bound very tightly, and you can put a potential difference across it. You can actually get a beam of electrons, and depending on how big a battery you put across here, you get a different energy for that field. So this is a very practical unit. And it's what you'll typically see. These days, or very often, you'll deal with energies that are much greater than just an electron volt. And it turns out that particle masses tend to be fairly large on the scale of electron volts, most of them, many of them. So on this scale, for example, an electron, well, remember that energy goes as mc squared. So if the energy is measured in electron volts, we talk about masses in terms of electron volts over c squared. And, there's this thing. I love this thing in many ways, this tablet PC I have. But Fujitsu designed it such that if you're going to connect it to a projector, you have to have it oriented a certain way. And then they put in the hardware right beneath the screen, when you have it oriented that way, something that is a scroll bar if you touch it. Which means when you have it oriented that way and you're trying to write it, your wrist just touches it. It goes crazy. So, sorry about that. At any rate, it's a bit annoying. So, note that we had E squared is equal to P squared c to the c squared, right? Did we get that right? C to the fourth. So note that the relationship between momentum and energy is scaled just by c. So mass goes as EV over c squared, and momentum goes as EV over c. Okay. So just in this sort of scale, it turns out the particles that have mass generally have a good bit more than just an electron hole. In fact, even the electron has a 500,000 electron volts worth of mass. So the mass of an electron in this scale is equal to 0.511 MeV over c squared. Now, in the spirit of trying to maintain a certain level of opacity in this business, very often you just drop the c squared. Just understood. Okay, so we talked about the mass of the particles, just in MeV. But that's an energy unit, not a mass unit, so you have to understand. And that's okay when you're just conversing about it, but when you want to actually calculate something, you need to remember to put in the c squared. Okay. I have to tell you, one of the most horrible moments in grad school or late undergrad if you're a physics major is when you're taking some advanced course and a theorist walks in and starts writing down all sorts of stuff that you're looking at and you're going, you know, I'm supposed to be familiar with this. And it's just not making any sense whatsoever. And then after a while, usually the theorist gets a little confused if you're not following. It's like, oh, right, how many units of C equals H particles of water? And so the way they work is they just drop all the C's and the H bars and all those constants. They just set it all equal to 1. Then you do your stuff, and then you basically use dimensional analysis to figure out where the C's and the H bars are going. So it's a... It's a horrible moment for us mere mortals that like to have the constants in there. Anyway, so the mass of the electron is 0.511 MeV. So let's say the proton has 938 MeV, almost 1,000 MeV over c squared. 1,000 MeV. 1,000 million is a billion, so we call it a GeV. Go figure. The next 1,000 up is TeV, so the LHC operates with energies and beams that are, you know, 6 or 7 TeV in energy, photons that have that kind of energy. Okay, but just for practical purposes, let's do a little bit with this. So if we have 1,000 MeV proton passing by, okay, what is its total energy? Total energy is going to be its rest mass plus its kinetic energy. So its rest mass, the mass of the proton is equal to 1.67 times 10 to the minus 27 kilograms. And you can take this and multiply it by c in meters per second squared and get it in joules per c squared. So this turns out to be equal to 1.5 times 10 to the minus 10 joules per c squared times 1 EV over 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joules per EV. or joules, sorry. And this ends up being the mass, which I told you of above. But so that's the mass of the proton. So that's the rest mass. Remember that the E total is equal to this E0, which is the mc squared, which is the rest mass term, plus the kinetic energy term. So the kinetic energy term is what you refer to when you talk about the 1,000 MeV, because that's the energy it gains if you put it through across the voltage. So the total energy is going to be 938 plus the 1,000 MeV. So you get 1938 MeV. So that would be the total energy. So this is a new sort of thing. You now have to worry about the rest mass. And you have to worry about what the kinetic energy really means. When somebody's talking about energy, are they including the rest mass or not? If you do particle physics and you start dealing with things at very high energies, you sort of get to the point where you ignore the rest mass again, because you're dealing with energies that are so much higher. But for most purposes, you have to worry about it. So the momentum of the particle E squared is equal to PC quantity squared plus this E0 squared. And so the momentum is equal to E minus E0 squared over C. So that's 1938 minus the 938, each of those squared, over C. And when you work that out, you get 1696 MeV, and the unit's now MeV over C. So another thing we could ask is, what is the velocity in the lab? So remember that the relativistic energy is gamma times mc squared. So this would be the mc squared is equal to 1 minus v over c quantity squared times total energy, that's the 1,000. Or v you can solve for is equal to c times 1 minus e0 over e squared. And so you can plug in the rest energy, the 938, and the total energy that we calculated, the 1938 or whatever it was. And when you do that, you get 0.87 times C. All right, so that's just sort of a going through very quickly kind of calculation that we may get asked to do in some of the problems. And it's not quite as straightforward as it used to be. You guys okay? Any questions? All right. So what I'd like to do now is to talk a moment about a physical effect that comes out of relativity, which turns out to have lots of experimental uses and very major effect on our view of the universe. And it is the relativistic Doppler shift of light frequency. I'm actually going to follow Gene Coley on this one. So So if you've read that, I'm not going to do anything fancier than that. So for the Doppler shift, what you do is, the idea is to think about how an observer perceives light that's emitted by a source. So just a reminder is that you perceive the color of the light as the frequency of the light. Right? That's what you see, as the color. And so for the Doppler shift, what I'd like to do is first consider that we have a source which is at rest in whatever reference frame we're in, and an observer at rest. And then I'd like to imagine light waves being emitted, and light, of course, has a wavelength. So what I'd like to do is to imagine light as a wave, and it's being emitted, and so you have one crest and then another crest, thinking of it as a wave. Okay? And the distance between those two crests, which in light you've learned is sort of the peak in the electric field strength or the magnetic field strength, if you want to think about it that way. We're just going to call lambda zero here. And I'd like to look at this phenomenon. What happens if I have the source moving with a velocity v? And the observer at rest in this reference frame. Okay. You can, the same thing is true if the observer is headed toward the source, it's just a different point of view. And in this case, let's say that when the source is at position one, you know, one of the wave crests gets emitted. During the time between the emission of those two wave crests, okay, remember the light will have a period between the arrival of the wave crest, the source moves to position two because it's moving. Okay? So it then emits the second crest. So the observer is going to see a wavelength here that is shorter than what you would expect to see if they were at rest. And so this distance here is v times the delta t between the emission of the wave crest. This distance is going to be the speed of light times the time between the emission of the two wave crests. You okay with that overall picture, conceptually? All right. So the wavelength, then, is going to be equal to C delta T minus V delta T. So I'm just... this distance is going to be equal to that long distance minus that distance. But the delta t is the delta t in the observer's frame of reference, which is different from the delta t in the source's frame of reference. Right? The source is in the proper frame. I'm in the source, and you know, I emit a crest, and then I emit another crest, or I have, you know, a charge wiggling, right, and it's up, and then it comes back up, right, and that's the period between the emission and the crest of the light, if you want to think of it that way. So this is the proper frame. All right, so that means that delta t is Lorentz. It is time dilated. So it's delta t is equal to delta t zero times gamma. Okay? So that means that this wavelength is equal to C times C minus V, sorry. Times gamma delta T zero. So this is C minus V over the square root of 1 minus V squared over C squared times delta T zero. I can pull the C through, and I get C minus V over the square root of C squared minus V squared times delta T zero times C. So basically I'm factoring the C out from here, and it ends up there. And this is lambda zero. This is lambda as measured in the frame of reference of the source. Okay? So we have a relationship now between the wavelength as measured by the observer and that in the source. This quantity is less than one, so this wavelength is shortened. You can convert this to frequency, because remember that velocity is equal to wavelength times frequency. I'm going to use nu for frequency for light. Jean Coley uses F, but if you look at light, you use nu. I don't know why I'm Doppler problems with light, but sometimes use F. You use F for sound, typically. I don't know. But if we switch to frequency, then nu is equal to nu zero C plus V over C minus V. So the frequency is increased. So the light goes blue when the source is moving toward the observer. The light is bluer than it looks to the source person. The observer sees the light as blue, and that would be the Doppler shift. It is, except for the time dilation, which is the different piece, it's very similar to what you've experienced with sound, right? You have the Doppler shift Doppler shift with sound, where you stand on the side of the road and somebody comes zipping by and sports car, right? Frequency is high coming at you and low going away from you. So this form, these are for the source and observer moving toward each other. And just to keep it maximally confusing, I'll put it in a different color. If they move away from each other, flips the signs, basically. So if they move away from each other, the frequency is small. So it becomes redshifted. So you okay with this? Alright. How would you know? How would you know the light is redshifted or not? You can ask the source what frequency they think they're emitting.
Wouldn't you know? Because if they're looking at like light from a star, they know what the spectrum should have based on what's in the star.
That's the trick. Yeah. So it turns out that light, and this is going to be something that we'll see throughout the semester, right? Because it's modern physics semester, so we're going to go and talk about atomic structure and stuff like that. But at a molecular level, or an atomic level, light is emitted by transitions between certain atomic orbitals in the atom. And those orbitals are those orbitals. They're characterized by how quantum mechanics is solved in a certain system of charged particles. So when they solve for the energy levels that are allowed on hydrogen atoms, and all hydrogen atoms would emit the same set of frequencies of light because it comes from transitions between one energy level to another. So it's very characteristic. So we're going to talk a lot about that. But what that means is any given atom emits certain colors of light. And if you have that atom here at rest, you know what those colors are, you know what the differences are between those frequencies. If you see that pattern emitted elsewhere, then you know that it was emitted by that atom. But if you see those frequencies coming in with the pattern right, but shifted to the blue or to the red, then that can tell you whether the star is actually, or whatever the source is moving toward you or away from you. So that's the deal. It's a very useful tool. And in fact, it turns out to be the foundation of some pretty strange stuff. So this guy, Vesta Slipher, I don't know if I say that correctly.
Slipher, I don't know.
At Lowell Observatory, was looking at galaxies in sort of the local quadrant. And what he found was that by looking at the spectral lines emitted by atoms in these distant galaxies, he found that they seemed to be mostly moved to the red a little bit, as if it seemed most of the galaxies were moving away from us. And that
was sort of interesting and bizarre. But then,
years later, Edwin Hubble and a guy named Milton Humason. Humason, it turned out, was working as a custodian in Mount Wilson Observatory. But he liked astronomy, and it turned out he was really, really sharp and very good with it. So he actually was working with Hubble. And Hubble was looking at distant stars, trying to figure out how far away they were by their luminosity. So if you could imagine, if I had a candle puts out a certain amount of energy, and that energy gets distributed over a sphere as it sort of goes out, which means the area grows as r squared. So the same amount of energy goes into r squared over the area. So the intensity of the light, which is the amount of energy per meter squared per second, drops as the square of the distance. So if I can measure the intensity of a candle, for example, and I know the certain distance, I can then see a candle at any distance and know how far it is by looking at the luminosity and the intensity of the light. So the trick to try to figure out distances in astronomy is to know what the... You can look at the intensity of a star. The trick is, do you know what the intensity is if you're up close to it? What is the absolute amount of light that's emitted by the object? So they're always looking for what we call standard candles. And it turns out that there's a type of star which varies in luminosity, and the period of the variation allows you to determine the absolute luminosity of the star. So then you can look at the star, you can look at its period, you can look at it, how bright it appears to you, and you can calculate how far away it is. So this is what Hubble was doing, and it works for single stars out so far as you can resolve stars. You can actually use this technique. And he and Humason took this, and they took Schleicher's measurements on redshifts, and they correlated the distance measured by Hubble to the velocity that you extract from the redshift of the spectral line. And you can see this very clear correlation. Not as clear as you sort of might have imagined. But this is their first data. And from this, Hubble extracted what's called Hubble's law, which is the further away a galaxy is from us, the faster it's moving away from us. And the constant proportionality is called Hubble's constant. So, why do we care?
Modern data looks like that.
And notice the distance scale has changed.
Hubble was looking at distances in megaparsecs out to about 2. A megaparsec is the distance that light goes in about 3 million years, so 3 million miles.
We since use standard candles that are supernova, certain types of supernova, and you can tell what type it is by how fast the light turns on, peaks, and then drops. They're extremely bright, so you can actually see them in very distant galaxies. So people do these supernova surveys and have actually identified supernovas from as far away as, say, 500 megaparsecs. And then they can do the same spectral analysis and figure out how fast it's moving away toward us. Okay? And when they do this, here is some fairly modern data. This is 1996. There's much more data out there, actually, so this wouldn't really be considered modern anymore. But this is an example. You can now see a very striking correlation. And it's sort of weird. It's like we have cosmic media or something, right? Everything is moving away from us. So what does that mean? And a way to think about it is the further away it is, the faster it's moving away from us. And the picture that this brings about is, imagine that you have raisin bread. You're going to make raisin bread. And you have some dough, and you stuff some raisins in the dough, right? And then you let it rise. And as it rises, of course, it fills the pan and becomes very big, and the raisins will all move apart from it. Imagine what happens if you consider two raisins that are close to one another. As it rises, they'll move apart from one another because there's some dough in between them that expands. But raisins that start out a little further apart from one another, they will move much further apart from one another in the same amount of time because there's much more dough between them that's expanding. So it turns out that you can analyze raisins in rising dough, if you wish, and come up with this type of relationship. If you were to calculate the recession velocity of the raisins from one another, those that are further, start out further from one another, will recede faster from one another than those that are closer. So this data tells us that the space in our universe is expanding with time. It's characterized by the Hubble constant. Yes.
What's the dough in space?
It's a good question. And why would it be expanding? Well, we're going to talk a little bit about expanding and have some time for this, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more. I think it's fair to say nobody really knows the answer to that question, but lots of people, there are lots of ideas that are out there, so it's not like, but it's very weird, right? Because now we live in this expanding universe, And up until this time, the idea was that you have this universe that's sort of always been here and always will be here, and that time has no start and has no end, right? And now you get this irrefutable data that the universe is expanding, which I guess you could swallow, except that means it was smaller. And if you extrapolate back in time, you get to zero at 13.7 billion years ago. So something happened. This is one piece of evidence. Okay, so what happened? So the idea is, well, it went bang, right? Mm-hmm. Now, it's not like a bang of a grenade, because the space isn't there for it to expand into, right? It's space itself that's expanding into it. So it's a little bit weird. The analogy I like to use is it's less like a zip than it is like your butt getting big as you get old. Because it sort of expands from within, okay? It doesn't explode out or whatever. So you may think that's sort of gross, but you're never gonna forget. Okay, so
the expanding universe.
Okay, we can go on and on and on about that, but basically the idea is, okay, something happened, I don't know what, and space started expanding, so we call that the Big Bang, okay? And the Big Bang has a lot of very fundamental problems with it, including what happens when you extrapolate down where you have all the energy in the universe at a single point. All of your equations just go to infinity. Okay? Everything goes crazy because even Coulomb, right? You have two charges, you can't have them infinitely close to one another without the energy and everything going crazy. So lots of infinities come up. There are lots of actual other fundamental problems with just the straight Big Bang. On the other hand, there's a whole lot of data that supports the whole basic idea of the Big Bang, because if you think about it, you have this universe and you go backward in time, and it's just like you are compressing air into a bicycle tire. Have you ever pumped up a bicycle tire and then actually felt the nozzle and felt that it was very hot? Or if you have a spray bottle of something and you spray it and feel the nozzle, it's very cold. It's a thermodynamic effect. When you take a gas and you expand it without having time for heat to flow, it cools down. Similarly, if you take a gas and you compress it, it heats up. So when the universe, if you go backwards in time and you compress it, it becomes much denser and it becomes much, much hotter. Okay? It becomes so hot that the universe as we know it doesn't exist, right? We have neutral atoms in our universe. Okay? You heat the universe up to the point that it's 3,000 degrees on average. That's too hot for neutral atoms to exist. So in fact, we have a plasma. Okay? You go hotter, you can't have nuclei exist. We have a quark-gluon plasma. You go hotter and they can't exist. So it turns out that even the forces of nature and what the particles are that exchange them have evolved as you go back in time or as you come out. So there are phase transitions in the universe that actually come about when you say that we have the Big Bang. And one of those phase transitions is the one where you have a transition between where you have a plasma where light cannot, if I have a charged gas, it turns out it's opaque, light doesn't really travel through it. So we have a universe that's very hot, you have lots of light bouncing around, but it can't go very far because it's a plasma. All of a sudden the universe is expanding and it cools down just enough that you have lots of neutral things forming. Now all of a sudden the light that's in the universe can travel freely. And the universe is not so dense, right? So it travels freely forever, basically, unless you look out. And if you look out all directions, you can see this light. It's called the cosmic microwave background. And it fits exactly the pattern that you would expect from a Big Bang-like thing. So as weird as this data may seem, and as strange as that idea is, there's little question scientifically that the Big Bang or something like it happened the second. So one of the things is, if you have this Big Bang, you might expect everything to be uniform. But it's not, right? Because we have planets and dogs and things like that. So it's not like all the matter is completely uniform. So one of the things that you would expect to see if you looked at this radiation from all directions is some non-uniformities in it in terms of its temperature distribution, because that would eventually lead, as that gas condenses, into clumps of matter, which is what condenses into stars and planets and such. Today's colloquium in the physics department is given by a guy who was leading the team that first saw that light, the structure in the plasma background. And he won the Nobel Prize in 2006 for that one. That's very, very cool stuff. Thanks, John Mather. Anyway, so go to it if you get a chance. He won't be talking about that. He'll be talking about the kernel stuff. So. Okay. I'm out of time, but go ahead. Say what? Yeah, when they start asking that, they're absolutely right.